Welcome back to AGR, Allied McGuard Radio. I'm Staff Sergeant Jacob Hearn.
And I'm Sergeant Megan Terry.
Today we have kind of a heavy episode, guys, so just a disclaimer that there will be talks of suicide and suicide ideation.
If you or any of your loved ones, your friends, your battle buddies are experiencing any type of mental health crisis, pick up your phone and call 988. That's the Veteran Crisis Line. And please do not leave any of your friends, your loved ones, or your battles alone during a time of crisis.
In this episode, we're sitting down with First Sergeant Robert Ray, who's been in the military for a long time. He's deployed all over, and because of that, he's seen a lot, including combat, and he's dealt with a lot, too. The mental strain, the physical strain, as well as the emotional strain that does to somebody. And he's here to talk about how he's dealt with that in his life and share some of his stories.
Looking at the different things that we have to deal with as soldiers, and dealing with those sacrifices, you know, the separation from family, it takes its toll mentally for you to have to leave your wife and kids, or it could just be the fact that you're leaving your parents or your brother or your sister or your nephews and nieces, you know. That time away really starts working on you. And there's different things I think people don't really realize until we come back home. We start looking at pictures of family events and like Halloween costumes or a birthday party or unwrapping presents at a Christmas, and you're like, why am I not in these pictures? Oh yeah, this was the year that I was gone. Like, you know, just all these memories that you weren't there physically for. And that, I think, can kind of take its toll on us. You know, you feel guilty, and you don't want to, because you were serving your country, and you were protecting, you know, in essence, you're protecting your family, just on a different scale. But having to deal with that and the ramifications that can come from that, I mean, it can take its toll on you mentally, I think.
First Sergeant Ray joined the infantry in 1989. From that point, he's been all over. Afghanistan, Iraq. If there was a deployment to the Middle East, he probably did it. Now he finds his home at the Fort McClellan Training Center, taking care of soldiers.
In the Iraq deployment, there was a lot more danger involved. And that's where you really, you know, when you're out in the field and you're leaving the safe haven of a FOB or a COB or whatever you want to call it, when you're leaving that base and you're out there unprotected and you're basing everything on your training, on your wits and your fellow, you know, soldiers that are out there, and you're going to encounter some things that really will take its toll on you mentally. When we're driving down roads, we would get hit with IEDs quite often. The good thing about the time frame that we were in, this is 04 time frame, 04, 05, they were still kind of learning in the area that we were in, so the IEDs weren't like huge, but they could still rattle you, and which was also their point too. If they're not gonna kill you, they're at least gonna get in your head. Maybe we don't want them coming out on these roads and checking out this particular area, you know. And I think our vehicle took about 7 hits. We always took track. You know, it's kind of the morbid part of being in the infantry. You want to, you know, we survived this many IEDs on our vehicles and stuff like that. And so you had the protection and everything with that. But when you're driving down those roads, it does take its toll after a while. And we're driving down roads that are in much worse condition than I-59 driving up towards Fort Payne. Like there's some holes in the roads that you're basically having to maneuver through and weave just to avoid, because that's where an IED was. And so you're driving down these IED-ridden roads or, you know, laden roads, and there could be another IED inside the hole that they had already made, because you think you're safe because, like, well, they're not going to use that area again, but they do. And so you're driving through there, and it's just like, you know, you've got to, pardon my phrase, but the pucker factor is quite high when you're driving down these roads, and you're on edge the entire time. And time after time, day after day, you're having to go out and do these missions, and you're like, why am I doing this? You know? Or why would I want to do this? And there was a point where I just didn't want to do it. And I was just like, man, what's going on? Like, this is my job as an infantryman. I cannot stop doing this job. And I just, it was like, I don't know, at that moment, I really had to because we were having to get ready to go out on a mission. I didn't want to go. And I'm like, this is not going to be the right mind frame that you have to have when you're going on the field. And I just took a moment and I was like praying to God. And it was like a moment of clarity where this peace came around and over me and said, you know, your family will be okay. If something were to happen to you, everything's going to be all right, you know. You know, they're going to be safe. And maybe the time that I spent with them prior to is enough where they'll remember, you know, things that I was there for them, you know.
Do you, and this might be kind of an unfair question, but do you think that's fair to think about with families that, hey, well, I might die, but my wife will be fine?
I knew that, you know, I lived my life right. I'd done everything to be a model father to my kids and a model husband to my wife. And so I didn't have any regrets, I guess, was kind of the perspective I was looking at as well. But the biggest part, I think, was that I could accept, if I were to die in the field, that everything that I'd left as far as to them, being who I was, and our marriage was in a great place and everything. And then after that, I was like, well, all right, I think I can do this mission now. I think I can get my focus back. And it was that moment that, you know, just, I wouldn't say it got better because there were still issues. There were still IEDs. There were still wires that you would find and try to identify and, you know, warning your troops and being there for your fellow soldier. But, you know, there was a lot of sacrifice in that. And that sanity, I think, that I finally got a hold of. I was about to lose it. I really did think I was about to lose my sanity at that point. But if it wasn't for that moment of clarity, I just don't know. I don't know if I'd have been able to make it back. Another instance, shortly after that, two instances really, that was the confirmation of not being invincible, but understanding that I'm okay so far. And while we're out there, we had the furthest out position with our Humvee. It was just me and my squad. And gunner up top, I was the TC, so I'm in the front on the radio. We're just kind of getting updates on what's going on further away from us. But our job was basically to make sure no one's coming down the street to interfere with what was going on in the middle, like we're on the outside. And the mission ended up going a little bit longer than normal, so we're out there for a few hours. My gunner, even though we come prepared, ran out of water. I was like, okay, I'll get out, get over here. We'll pop the top and get you some water and everything. And as I'm around the back end of the Humvee and I pop the trunk, I dropped the water. I was like, ah, and I looked down and I'm standing on top of three IEDs, like right there on top of me, the shells. We had submerged them a little bit when we rode over them to set up where we were, but we never saw them. It was out of the gunner's view to know. So I'm right now on top of these things, and that, good thing I wasn't wearing white shorts at that day or anything, but I mean, just what was going through my head was like, you know, holy cow. You know, what could happen is someone watching me right now and is going to pull that trigger. So I very hurriedly, but not letting anybody know, you know, hand the water to the gunner, get in the truck. I'm like, okay, we got to move. We need to move now and get out of here. And we moved further up, got 300 yards away. I think that was the distance that they wanted us to do. We called in the EOD guys and they came over and they blew it in place. But they said that was a whopper. Like y'all literally dodged a bullet on that one. And that was, whew, boy, that's a moment that, you know, again, in that mental state, you're like, holy cow. The other one, and this one's relatively funny, but not in a way when you think about it, but we came under a mortar attack and we were in a potato factory. That was our little sub base because it had already the fencing and everything around, and we were in one of the storage containers for the potatoes. So you're looking at the structure, you're thinking it's like steel walls. Hey, we're safe in this little area. We can, you know, we'll lay up our cot. You're done. This is our little safe haven. And during the mortar attack, I was laying down. I had just come off mission, really. And so I was laying down, and one of my escapes was the PSP. I don't know if people know what the old Sony PlayStation, it was a little portable. This is my escape, you know, playing this video game. So I'm sitting there playing this video game, and then the mortar attack occurs. And as I'm laying down there, it was like, and the only thing I can compare this to was if someone took an aluminum baseball bat and came up and just swung as hard or as fast as they could and struck me in the leg. And it was to the point where it immediately had me come up out of the bed. And then everybody's like scrambling because we obviously heard the impact and everything of what was going on. And it didn't register to me until I tried to stand. And my left leg went a little like, I'm like, what? And I look down and I've got a little bit of blood going. And I'm like, man, I'm hit. I was like, this is not cool. And I was like, this, you know, I'm laying down on a bed. This is no glory of being caught by some piece of shrapnel or something, which is what it ended up being. And of course, you know, my battle buddies are there and they're like having me go limp into the little TMC area that they had established at this little post. And they're trying to dig through and get any kind of metal fragments out of me and everything. And so I was just, ugh. But it was one of those things. But at the end of it all, a couple of the guys went up to the roof after everything was done. The mortar attack only lasts, you know, there's only like three shells at the time, and then it was done. It was almost like when you watch MASH and they have 5 o'clock Charlie, he comes in, he drops three bombs, he's gone for the day, he may come back in about a week. That's kind of how it was over there. You'd get the three shells and then, you know, everybody's on break after that, just knowing that we're not going to get mortared. So afterwards, the guys go up to the roof to kind of check out and assess the damage, and they had found the tail fin. And it turns out of all the things that prevented anybody else getting hurt, because a couple people got peppered with some shell fragments and everything. But there was a huge beam that had held or part of the structure of the building that took the brunt of the impact. And that beam was right above me. So again, one of those things where I'm not trying to feel like I'm invincible, but at the same time, I'm like, holy cow. You know, it's just all these little things that occur that you're just like, man, what in the world? What have I gotten into? What am I, again, why am I here? You know, what is this? But those little things that we were able to get through, and we had other people going through the same thing. We've had, within our group, we had guys get pretty lit up with an IED. Fortunately, no lives were lost in that group, but they got rattled pretty good. You know, all these things that are happening, and it just makes you so hyper aware of what's going on out in front of you and everything. And so, yeah, I say that, all that, to say this. You're enduring all this, you know, inadvertently being shot at. There was one really major attack that, well, yeah, one really major attack that we took on at the FOB that we were able to endure. And there was some satisfaction in that because all that training that we had done and everything that we had done had paid off. And
since you said that on your team during that experience, you were older compared to some of like the, you know, fuzzies it sounded like, or the brand new kids.
Right.
Did you have any of the younger soldiers that like looked to you for guidance, or was there conversations happening about like, how do we do that? How do we focus in on what we have to do?
So I don't know if we ever directly hit with that, but what I did as a leader, and I was just an E6 at the time. So if anything, I was just a squad leader. I wasn't like a platoon leader at the time. We had a great platoon leader though, and he instilled strength in us as well. One of the things that happened after we had taken our first IED, and I'll throw his name out there too, Sergeant Brown. He was a great master sergeant for us. He took me and my battle buddy, which was, and now Sergeant Major Ratcliffe, he took us aside and he was like, I don't want this to sound bad, but I'm glad y'all got hit with that IED. We're like, what? And he's like, well, for one, you're all alive. But two, now you're going to know how to react. Because now that fear of, you know, getting hit is somewhat taken away. So now you will be able to react a little bit faster in what you're doing. And so we had moments like that. But what Ratcliffe and I did, we joked around. I wouldn't say it was like MASH. It wasn't like Hawkeye and you know, but and BJ. But we tried to keep everything somewhat on an even keel. So we knew when the stress was up, we would have to turn up a little bit on, you know, getting a little bit of funny in there just to get a smile over somebody. And so we knew as leaders, we would have to give some kind of an example to these young soldiers and everything they were going through. We tried to set that example and that tone that, you know, everything's going to be all right, and that we would be there for them.
What was really surprising to Staff Sergeant Hearn and myself was when First Sergeant Ray shared with us the most difficult part of his deployment didn't happen overseas. It happened when he came home.
We knew we were there for each other when we were overseas. When you come back home, it's a different story. And nowadays, I think when you were looking at some of the historical aspects, the World War II, the World War I, soldiers, it took quite a while for them to come back home. Like, they're on ships. It's weeks, could be months in transition from being in the field to coming back home. Whereas with us, I think you were literally 3 or 4 days and you're back home. You know, the turnaround of coming back to Fort Stewart, I think we were practically done in three days. And then we're maybe 2 or 3 days of a transition to get back to your house. And then you're home. And that's not a lot of time to really process a lot of that stuff that happened while you were out there. You know, when I was back and in that shorter time, there were times where I didn't want to leave the house because I was conditioned for a year to be with my weapon. Like an infantry guy, we're sleeping with the weapon. And do you have it by your side at all times? When you're leaving outside of your area, you've got your vest and your helmet on. I realized that for almost 3 or 4 weeks, I didn't want to leave my house because I didn't have my weapon, I didn't have my vest, I didn't have my helmet. Like, I didn't want to go outside to even cut the grass because I was coming out unprotected. I was coming out naked. Like, how am I going to be able to protect myself if, you know, I was in that mindset still. And that was tough. My wife got on to me because I'm driving down the road and I'm in a 50 mile per hour zone and I'm going 30. And she's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I realized I was scanning the road. You know, I'm looking for boxes. I'm looking for potential threats while I'm on the road because I'm protecting my family. Just like I protected my family when I was in that Humvee. You know, those soldiers were my family. And so I think there's a lot of issues that we have with that we, like, A, turning that switch back on as far as, you know, your life, but B, overcoming the things that you've gone through and, you know, just trying to get in the right mindset of when you're back home. One of the things we're very proud of is all of us made it back. Zero KIAs within Alpha Company, the 167th. So we were very proud of ourselves on that because that's when you know all that training paid off and everything. So you come back home, you got 45 days worth of leave built up, I think was the magic number, where we didn't have to do anything. We were still collecting our check. I didn't have to immediately go back to work or anything. And so for, you know, those 45 days, you're kind of taking it easy, other than the fact I didn't want to leave the house for a couple of weeks. But in that time frame, about a month into, one of our guys committed suicide. And he was not very far from me as far as where I was living. And that was the most devastating thing I think that could possibly happen. You know, one of the things that we never really thought about was still contacting each other when we got back home. And I think that's been improved on now. I think there's a lot more access to people that can help people in turning on that switch and getting that switch back on. And then I think it's been emphasized more on the units as well when you're coming back home that you are talking, that you don't just cut off and go back to your life, but to still contact those guys that you were with and see how they're doing, you know. And I think we did know too, and it was unfortunate that the suicide brought us back together a little bit faster in that 45 days that we were off. But I think we all realize we need to be talking. like, we need to start talking about some of this stuff that maybe we buried, or maybe we didn't think about, or maybe I didn't think about it, but man, this may have really affected this guy, you know. So maybe we should start talking about some of this stuff. Or maybe I can get you to someone who you need to talk to, because I'm no professional. But we can talk about the fact that we went through it together. You know, and it's amazing how little things will trigger you. I think it was well after the 45 days. Cause, well, I know it was because I was on my way to work. And it was just a particular piece of music. I don't know what it was about that song. I don't know if it was in a movie, like maybe it was in some war movie that I saw, and it made me revert back to something that happened in Iraq. But I just broke down. And I had to pull off the road because I couldn't concentrate to drive because I was just bawling. And I don't know if it was a little bit of a mix of just being on the road and listening to the music and referring back to something that may have been in a movie, or the fact that I had just lost a friend to suicide, or if it was just a culmination of everything. But I couldn't, I don't know. A year later, and I relayed that, and I think Radcliffe got onto me immediately. Man, why didn't you call me? Like, right when that happened, you should have been calling me and talking to me about it. And I was like, I don't know. It was just hard to process trying to figure out what triggered it in the first place. And then, but then just, you know, after I had my moment there, I was able to kind of gather myself back up and get back on the road. And then, you know, I got to work and let work kind of preoccupy my mind again. So I almost like shut it to the side. But maybe I should have talked about it. And then, well, of course, we did talk about it after that. And you're like, well, what do you think triggered it? I have no idea. You know, we just started going over some of the things that we went through. And we're like, you know, we went through more than what we were just thinking. You know, maybe there were some more instances that we were just like, just kind of buried over time. And it kind of is scary in a way, but it makes you really consider talking to some professionals to see, like, maybe I need to let some of this stuff out so that, you know, something doesn't happen. I think the biggest thing is that this, I guess we get caught up on the guard because it's just one week in a month that we're seeing these people, some in some cases, and then 2 weeks out of the year. It's getting to know that soldier a little bit more than just on that weekend. Spending time with them and getting to know a lot of the ins and outs. And sometimes it can help you in the motivation. You know, if they're in a moment where they're needing some clarity, if, you know, do you want to, you know, think about the fact that your wife's back home. Let's get out on this mission. Let's focus on the mission so that we can get you back home to her. You know, that kind of thing. So I think getting to know the soldiers more intimately, I think, being able to know more about them and what's making them tick. Why did they join the Army? Why are they in this? What do they do on the civilian side? So that you know more about them. And then in turn, that person, that soldier's going to sit there and go, he does know about me. You know, he does care about me. If he's telling me to do something, maybe I should do it because he's looking out for me and, you know, the things I have back home, because he knows what things I have back home instead of just a soldier, you know. But, I mean, the emphasis of resiliency, it's huge. And we see the numbers still staying steady on people committing suicide, even if they haven't deployed. And I think that's one of those things where we still have to know ourselves, like know that person that you're working with, even if it's a cubicle dividing you. Get over there and talk to them, you know, get some interaction, have Hawaiian Shirt Friday, I don't know, something that's going to entertain. But I think it's just keep on looking out for each other, not just at while you're at work, but even after, you know, give a call, give a little text, throw a Facebook thumbs up or something. But just being there for each other all the time. I mean, just don't cut that off. And don't just limit it to those 2 days out of the month.
Despite everything First Sergeant Ray went through and how hard it was for him coming home, he did have a lot to say about the newfound appreciation he had for his life here, his life back home, and what going overseas meant for him, his family, and everyone else he knew.
I have so much more appreciation for anything. Like, coming back home, I don't think I ever had more of appreciation for green grass. Like, just being in a desert the entire time, Have an appreciation for my kids just to have clothing and shoes on their feet, because you were seeing so many kids just walking around literally in garbage day in and day out, like just looking for something that they could use or looking for scraps of food or something. And I'm coming back home to where, man, I'm having to watch my weight for a weigh-in or a PT test or something. You know, there's the appreciation of just what I have. And the house doesn't have to be a glorified house. As long as we have a roof over our heads, we don't have chickens and cows in our living room, that's a blessing, you know. I think there was just a huge appreciation for things. And I think it helped me. I guess I have enough. It instilled with us a good confidence in the fact that everything that we'd been doing for so many years, you were going to a weekend drill and 2 weeks out of the year. If I have to go to Camp Shelby one more time to do all this training, where's the payoff? And I think that was the biggest accomplishment that we, like, that was just the biggest thing coming back home, was this sense of accomplishment that all that training that we did paid off. And then we're gonna keep on training, because you never know what's around the corner, you know, what's gonna happen next. But you got that encouragement that you did everything that you were supposed to do, that all that training, you didn't think twice when it came down to the means of having to do something, to have to act or have to react.
First Sergeant Ray, thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and talk with us. Your story is one that has the potential to impact other people's lives. And now we get the chance to sit down with our good friends, Jason and Darius.
Right, yeah, my name is Darius White, and I do suicide prevention here for the Alabama Army National Guard.
My name is Jason Smith. I'm the Resiliency Risk Reduction and Suicide Prevention Program Manager for the Alabama National Guard.
Jason and Darius are both suicide prevention coordinators for the state. You've actually met Darius before if you've listened to the show. He was on our first episode. But I want to take a second to describe these two, because they're very different, but they both work in the exact same field. Jason is an ex-Marine. He looks the part. Honestly, he looks a lot like my stepdad, who's an ex-Marine. Bald, goatee, tattoos, the works. You've seen him before, if you know an ex-Marine.
Big, burly, seems intimidating at first, but at the end of the day, he's actually like a big teddy bear.
Yeah. And then we also have Darius, young guy, dreads, earrings, really cool, really laid back. But he's not a veteran. He's a military child. But both of them are in the same field, and although they both come from completely different backgrounds, you can tell this is a subject that they care about, and they really care about the soldiers that they're taking care of.
I'll share my story. I share my story a lot. Most people who have heard me speak, they kind of know my story and where I'm coming from. I did 20 years in the Marine Corps. I've got a wife and two kids. Very blessed. However, while I was in the Marine Corps, you know, back-to-back deployments, you know, Iraq, Ramadi, 2007, 2008, then back to Al-Assad, Syrian border in 2009. Around 2010 is when I lost my first Marine to suicide. And, you know, at the time, that concept was kind of foreign to us. We were, you know, we're in the military, it's kind of that suck it up, buttercup mentality. We don't talk about our problem. We don't talk about any of that stuff. And that started to be one of the biggest things that led to a lot of my problems, and I would not talk about things. I drank, and I drank for fun when I got in the Marine Corps. I drank for fun when I was in high school, but there turned a point in my career where drinking became a coping skill every night. Going to work and being a high performer was a coping skill. It was a constant, and you just couldn't go speak to somebody about mental health, you know, and that was, I think, a tragic point looking back now at, you know, some of the things that caused. And then when I got out of the Marine Corps, that's when things got really different. You know, I think we had talked earlier about trying to transition from the military over to civilian life, and I did not transition well into corporate America, because you don't have that tribe, you don't have that environment that you thrived in for 20 years. And plus, anything that you had going on, you know, for me, I couldn't share that with anybody. I didn't know how to talk about it. And finally, you know, there's a point in life where you hit rock bottom. And I can tell you my story kind of like this. We were talking about land nav earlier, and I tell everybody, man, you can go 3 degrees in the wrong direction for a short period of time. It won't make that big of a difference. But if you keep doing land nav for 50 to 100 miles to 1,000 miles, 3 degrees in the wrong direction, it's going to catch up with you. And the alcohol, the anger, the not wanting to go get help type stuff eventually called up, and it was disastrous 2 years after I retired. And I had to end up going to treatment. for alcohol. And it wasn't just the alcohol, that was just the outside layer of the onion that I was dealing with, you know. And what I didn't realize, I had two kids, you know, Darius is gonna share his story about being a dependent child. And, you know, in my mind, I was in a silo thinking about all the bad stuff and ruminating over these negative things all the time. And the alcohol was my coping skill. It was supposed to help me sleep and all, and it didn't. None of that stuff really helps. And I was worried about what my Marines would think about me if I went, you know, that told them I went and got help. And, you know, all that stuff that we think in our minds sometimes, that imagination dragon, I call it, in our head, makes things a whole hell of a lot worse than they really are. When I got out of treatment and called my Marines and told them where I'd been, most of them were going through some of the same stuff, man. Most of them were dealing with some of the same things I was dealing with. And the one question a lot of them asked me was, like, why didn't you call me? And why didn't you call me and just say, man, I need some help? And right there, that's when my eyes opened up. And I started pouring myself into this role, what I'm doing now, a couple years ago, doing peer support. So I do peer recovery support. So I help other veterans and military members who are struggling with alcohol and drugs and things like that. But it's the resiliency piece that I think I was missing in my life, because we were only taught a few skills in the Marine Corps, and it was like, go work out, go to church, or you're going to drink. It was like those three things about all your coping skills you had, you know, with your buddies. And man, there's so much more out there. And then I know from when I got sober, hearing my kid's story, you know, my daughter tell me, you know, Daddy, I was watching the news, and they were talking about where you were at, and I just go in my room and cry. You know, we don't think about what the kids, the families are dealing with from a resiliency standpoint. So it's a very unique perspective from them as well. So, but as far as, you know, where I'm at now in my life, it's my eyes are definitely open. I make it a point to share the story, because I believe stories save lives. And a lot of times the check-in-the-box training doesn't work. It's a waste. It truly, if it did work, we wouldn't have the problems we're having now, right? I think it takes getting kneecapped, being genuine, telling real stories. Because somebody in that crowd is going through that same thing, or knows somebody, and they know, man, just call this person, or just think about doing this way, man, you know, reach out. So, I got sober, you know, and there's a good part of this. Went back to college, got my master's degree. I worked for a great little gun store down here in Montgomery, Walter Craig. I love them to death. They, you know, my best friend worked there. They took me in. I went to school, got my master's. Came here to the National Guard, worked for a year. Then I left here and went to Black Rifle Coffee Company. Was HR manager there for 2 years. That was kind of crazy. I can never do HR again. Left there and went to Bradford, the place where I got sober, and started helping vets, man, and got a lot of folks into treatment, man. And then this position opened up. And so now I'm on the resiliency side of the house. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's all about building a tribe. And I think that's what Darius and I and the rest of the resiliency team are trying to do, is building a team of resources and people we can reach out to at any time of the day, and just let everybody know it's okay to reach out and get some help. So,
is it different with the Marines? Do you feel like the mental health culture is different, or was different, or doesn't matter? This is a military thing.
Right. I mean, if you look at the numbers, you can see the numbers of the Marine Corps and the Army are significantly higher than the Navy and the Air Force. You look at number wise. You still got a motley crew of characters in all branches, and we all have our own stigmas. So I think stigma in general, it tends to revolve around worried about being viewed as weak. It revolves around worried about losing your security clearance or somebody finding out about your business. But I think in general, it's all about the same. And I think too, and I like to rope in our first responder community, because a lot of our National Guard members serve as first responders. That's another culture that's very similar to ours. And they see a lot of trauma day in and day out, and don't, you know, they take a lot of that stuff home and don't know how to get it out, you know, when they're off work. So I think it's just the culture of the people who raise their right hand and protect others that run into the fight, not away from it. I think that crew just tends to be a little bit more self-reserved about their feelings and about what they believe and who they can tell. You know, I was doing a new hire orientation this morning, and I said, you know, it's weird. It's like, if you hurt your knee, you'll go to the doctor. You'll get put on limited duty, and then you'll go to rehab and get your knee worked out and get that taken care of so you can get back in the fight. But if you're having a mental health issue, you won't say nothing. You know, and that's really controlling everything. And you know, this stuff all ties together. Drinking wasn't the thing that my problem was. My problem was I couldn't sleep. And I couldn't stop thinking about things, and I had chronic pain, and I wasn't eating right, and I wasn't PTing like I used to when I was in the Marine Corps, and I was drinking every night, and I was getting angry. See, there's like this big cycle that you get in. It's not just one thing. And like I said, we can take care of the broken leg or the messed up knee, but we won't go take care of that one thing that really controls all the other aspects of our life. So. Mm.
Do you think when you were downrange, it was easier to shut it off, and then when you got home, it was much harder?
Yeah, I think so. When we were in Ramadi, we lived in a little house downtown, in downtown Ramadi, and there were seven of us on my team sleeping in the same room together. We only had six beds, and so we would rotate out. And we had to cook our meals, and we had a, like a line to dry our clothes on. But we ate dinner every night when we weren't out. We ate together. We were constantly together. And I don't know. I tell people, like, man, even though we had mortars going off, we had rounds going off, some nights, man, I just slept better there than I did when I got home. It was just a weird thing. Because you're around that group of people and you're so tight and you are talking. You do have that connection when you're downrange deployed. And then when you get back, you don't have, you know, it's just not something you normally talk about. I think one thing is you got to remove the barriers. You know, we talk about this a lot. There's still a lot of barriers out there. If you get a group of Marines or soldiers together and ask them, hey, how many of you probably wouldn't say anything about your mental health? Half the people still raise their hand and say, man, I'm worried. And they'll tell you those things I told you earlier about security clearance, all the other mess. I think we got to remove that and make it clear that this is a big part operationally, how you operate. Your mental health has a lot to do with that, and so be open about that. To the connection part, you know, like I said, when I was in Ramadi the first time, that core group of guys, we've been together, and we're like still close friends till now. And back to that analogy of World War II, yeah, they spent time together, you know, on R&R for months before they even came back home. Whereas, you know, I'm on the Syrian border this day. 2 days later, I'm back in North Carolina, Camp Lejeune, you know, with my family, just getting right back at it. I don't know if we can do anything about that because life just moves that fast nowadays. But I think before, you know, leaving a combat zone or leaving a deployment, like we've got National Guard members all over the place, having some type of stand down before they leave and before they go there. I know we do the yellow ribbons and we do a lot of that stuff like that, but I think commanders need to take a hard look, and I think staff NCOs and NCOs take a hard look at your platoons and just have those conversations. Have a guided discussion with your folks and see, just get a thermometer check, see how they're feeling and whatever. I mean, that's all you can really do. I think building connections is key, though.
Do you think that the connection between each other is enough, or do you think that connection needs to be encouraged between the families as well?
Yeah, so great question. So I think we're not really taught how to communicate very well with our spouses, okay? And so one of the things I do at a yellow ribbon, and the spouses are there, we talk about connection. A lot of times when we're going downrange, we're getting ready to go downrange, we're very focused, we're highly focused, super focused on the mission, what we're doing. And then we're downrange for 9 months to a year or whatever, we're super focused on all that. It's hard to translate all of that back and be able to have that conversation with the spouse or with the kids. You know, I think professionally, what I could have done better as a Marine is just doing simple things like just told my wife how much I appreciate her more. For what she did while I was gone. See, I was playing Marine downrange while she was at home taking care of the kids, taking them to doctor's appointments, taking them to baseball, football practice, make sure the yard was doing all the things that I was normally doing when I was there. And I'd forgotten about that, and I just forgot to tell her thank you, you know? And I think when you get back, I think there's a way we can help soldiers and family members connect on a higher level as far as not just, hey, how you doing, connect. I mean, I really have those deep conversations. Hey, I'm feeling a certain kind of way. I'm glad you did this, or I'm glad you did that, or just simply telling somebody thank you. I think we might be missing the boat on that.
Of course, I'm not a vet. Jason here, he's definitely a vet, but like my dad is a vet. And when they're talking about all the stories that they're sharing, it's interesting because like, I can provide you the lens of like a dependent being back home while their parent is deployed and all that stuff is going on, and like the worries and anxieties kind of that I have built up, the fear of like what could happen, you know, to a parent when they're gone, you know, like if you're, what's constantly, you know, like going on. And this is just kind of like through the lens of like the child. I've always imagined, you know, like life of things, what they could be, like what my dad could be experiencing, what he could be seeing. But then, you know, like you hear the phone calls, you know, then you'll see what's on TV, and you'll kind of like put two and two together and be like, wow, this is like really happening, you know? And again, like sometimes the conversations like back home, like are shorter than others, you know? And it's just like, so, as a kid, you really don't understand what's happening. But I think my dad, he did prep me at least well to be able to be like, hey, well, I'm leaving, you know, like, so like, you're gonna have to step up, you know, like, and do things. It was a weird transition because, you know, I grew up in South Carolina, and one of the things that people really don't understand about like being a child of a military service member, like, you serve just the same as they serve, you know, like, so wherever my dad's job went, you know, like, we had to follow. So imagine establishing, you know, like, your community, your tribe, your identity, who you are, and then, you know, having all that taken away from you. So you leave everything that you know, your family, your community, imagine leaving the country. So now you're isolated. You're like, hey, why am I doing this? You know, things kind of change. You start getting used to that, you know, like, hey, well, we get comfortable, build the roots, build the community, and then it's just time to leave again, right? 3 years in Japan, 5 years in Korea, then they moved back to Japan. By now, you know, like, I'm grown, you know, like, I graduated high school, moved back to the States, I'm going to college. Meanwhile, they're still doing, you know, they're hopping. My life is still progressing, but like, I still don't have the community, the family, the roots, because like, I've already been uprooted from that. So that's kind of just like my lens, but that's not even, you know, calculating like the worry, the constant worry of like, hey, well, my dad, he's gone, he's over there in the war zone, he might not come back, you know, like, these are things that are constantly on your mind. You try to do your best, you know, not to think about it, especially if you have a big family, you know, but, you know, put on a brave face for your mom, because you can only imagine what she's going through. So it's kind of like carrying the weight of like everything, you know. And I don't know if like every child feels like that, but I bet, you know, if you looked up the statistics, you feel me, and if you implemented a survey, I guarantee you, like, every single military child, you know, they can relate with this feeling.
Do you have any resentment for like your upbringing?
That's a very, very good question. To be honest, I'm conflicted. And I think it's really right on cue and right on schedule, because while I was blessed to be able to like travel the world and experience various different cultures and, you know, kind of like live financially free, you know, like, again, like, I kind of live a spoiled lifestyle, but I don't know kind of what is better, you know, living that lifestyle and then having to come back to like reality, or rally a check, and then like things not being the way that they were growing up, you know, like, so like relearning, reestablishing like who you are, where you fit in. So yeah, I think that was really, really huge. Like, it's always been missing in my life. And so I guess to answer your question, I don't think I've built up resentment. I can't be mad at my parents, you know. I can't be mad, you know, like, at my friends and at my family, you know, like, this isn't their doing. So it's kind of like I've been angry at the military this whole time, right? If I'm just going to be honest, it's just the culture of it. But they fail to realize, like, you have nothing, you know, like, that really makes up your identity with you by the time you go through the process of, like, being a military child. Like, there's nothing left. Don't get me wrong. There are a lot of programs, you know, that try to help. Simply put, what we are experiencing even nowadays, and I'll kind of, like, relate it back to this job and what we do. Most of the services, right, that we're telling these service members to go out, or these veterans to go out to, right, they're getting serviced by a civilian, you know, like, who has no idea, you know, like, what background they come from, or like, really what problems they might be experiencing, like, really the depth of like the military family. And so while the blueprint, you know, like, for services may adequately fit, you know, like, your normal family, there are definitely factors that that really, you know, like, relate to the military family that are just not simply being met. And so, yeah, there's not a lot, but again, like, this is kind of one of the reasons why we're doing what we're doing, because we have to change that. Like, there's a lot of misunderstanding and misinterpretation from, like, civilians to the military community, and again, the stigma and all that is kind of, like, the stuff that we really have to, like, combat.
So I had a question. There's a lot about prevention and resiliency in all of our training, mm-hmm. all the PowerPoints, and there's not a lot about dealing with people in crisis. Yeah, I don't know if that's something you deal with day to day or month to month either, but how do you prep yourself? What do you need to do? What is that like to be with somebody who's going through that life or death crisis in that moment?
So, you know, I had one yesterday. I told y'all briefly this morning. A good buddy of mine was deployed with in Ramadi. Let me tell you this. It's the Alabama Department of Health's got a program called Peer Support, and I say that to the masses out there who have let's say you've recovered from alcohol or you've lived through a mental health crisis and you've recovered, I would challenge you to go through that 5-day course and learn how to be a peer to somebody else. And we're not the only, like the military is picking up on it, but the law enforcement community is picking up on the peer program. The peer program is designed to help you have that tough conversation, because you're not going to get that call at 3 o'clock in the afternoon most of the time. It's going to be like 2 in the morning. Like, what do you do? Who do you talk, who do you call, who do you talk to? And that's very critical, you know which route to go. And I know we've got multiple numbers around here with the EOC line, the 988 with the one for veterans and all that stuff. But how I go about doing it, and I've taken multiple calls when I worked for Bradford and when I worked at Black Rifle, I was still doing peer recovery support. So I would get those calls with somebody who was struggling with something. The number one thing you can do is answer your phone. Answer your phone when somebody calls you at 2 in the morning. Answer the phone. Mm-hmm. And the number two thing you can do, as a peer, I'm not there to give anybody advice. I'm not there to tell you what you need to do. I'm going to share what worked for me. I'm going to share what I've been through. And a lot of people take from those stories and go, yeah, I do want to make a change. I can tell you you're going to go to treatment, but, when you tell somebody to do something, they don't listen, right? They're just not going to listen. They've got to make it their own idea. So in that moment, let them just do the talking, share their story, man. Like, look, I was at the bottom of a barrel too, man. I get it. I had that bottle in my head every night. I was in that silo by myself. I saw the same things replaying in my mind. I couldn't communicate with my wife, couldn't communicate with my kids. Yeah. Wanted to walk out. Like, that's how I felt, man. I get it. And they end up feeling the same way. And then before you know it, you've got a common ground. Yeah. Look, man, I went to treatment. This is where I went. This is what I did. I went to the VA, and they gave me a referral. And I went there for 30 days, and I got treatment afterward. And, like, I just kind of share my story, But like initially yesterday when this Marine called me and he was having a crisis, it was a risk factor, relationships, it was marital issues, and he was having anxiety. And I mean, bad through, like, I've never heard him like this before. And the first thing I said to him is, I want you to go to the VA in Macon, Georgia right now, and I want you to go to the triage, a mental health triage. And that's what I tell somebody if they have a crisis. You can go to any emergency room. You can go to the VA that's got an emergency room if you got a VA, but get somewhere right away, okay? So that's like, but knowing the resources. So if you've got a National Guard member who has got veteran status, they can go to any VA, right? They can go to any emergency room. If they've got insurance, they don't have insurance, they still can go to an emergency room, get them somewhere, or get to the house. Don't ever pass them, but don't ever give somebody a number and tell them to call. Yeah, like, that's the, like, my biggest gripe is when somebody says, yeah, here's this number, call them. Yeah. You do a warm handoff. You call that person for them. Get them on a three-way call. Walk them through that. You will be surprised how much of a difference that will make, because that builds trust. And I think the community partners we have now that we're working with, and we had this work just not too long ago with the crisis intervention team at the Huntsville Police Department and the veteran recovery team at the Huntsville VA. They contacted me. They had a veteran on site who was trying to commit suicide by a cop. And the cop was in one of our classes we did for PTSD and anxiety. And I said, stay on the line. And I pulled in Sergeant Schiff from the Huntsville VA. He walked down to Dr. Swanner's office, who is the director of psychiatry there, got him. They went out, got the guy, brought him over, and got him in, got him some help right away. Got him over, actually took him over to the emergency room in Huntsville. But it took everybody working together, because this thing could have gone the wrong direction quick with that police officer. Luckily, that police officer was trained and how to handle a veteran, Yeah. So I think that's key. Answer your phone, do a warm handoff with somebody, and know the resources. And these 501Cs, a lot of them are great, but they're not open past 5 o'clock, and they're not going to answer the phone, so you got to know the right people to call. And it's always going to be your 988. A lot of your police departments are going to have what's called crisis intervention teams. If you will call your local police or sheriff's department, ask them, hey, do y'all have a peer support or crisis intervention team that can go out to this house and do a check on one of my guys or gals? They'll go out there and do it. And if they know they're a vet or a service member, they'll know how to act with them. So I think that's important. And then following up with them, go visit them, if they're getting some help, man, it makes a world of difference, so.
Yeah, I like to kind of like add on to that. I receive calls, very, very frequently. Oftentimes people are just, a little bit too worried or concerned about, am I gonna say the right thing? Am I gonna say the wrong thing? Oftentimes I'm approached, at when I do go to give briefings on a drill weekend, someone might be like, hey, this person is or they have been in this room, you know, like for the whole day. And I'm just like, well, that's not doing them any good, right? So I think just showing up is number one, you know. Like you said, the worst thing that you can do is not show up, you know. So most people are just saying, well, like, don't go if you don't have to. My thing is, like Jason said, I'm not going to send you to a number or a place, you know, like after a certain hour, right, if I don't trust it. You know, if you say that you need help, you need help, and there's probably a reason why they called you, right, or why you were called. It's because they trust you. They don't want to go see a random person at a random place, right, after hours. Oftentimes, all they want to do is just be heard out, right? So as Jason was saying, I think affirmation is what I heard, right? They want to be affirmed, like, hey, acknowledge what they're going through, right? They're going through a difficult time, and right now they cannot see any end to it, right? I've been there, you know, so I kind of like understand like where the mental is when it's exhausted all its resources, it's reached out as much as it can, it's done all it knows, you know, like, and there's literally no other options. And that hopelessness, right? Hey, there's nothing else I can do. That's why it is important to reach out beyond yourself, because there's someone else that knows more than you do. They know someone that you don't. And your ability to tap into that resources, right? That's a huge protective factor in itself. Just knowing that there is something, there's some sort of chance that can help me out. There's some sort of remedy, some sort of medication, some sort of treatment, right? These people are like, hey, they're stuck in their head. And they want to know what their options are, really, you know, so reach out to someone. I would say going through suicide and experiencing a mental health crisis like that is the equivalent of hell, right? And the thing about saving people from hell is, like, you have to go back there, you know, if that makes sense. And so, like, one of the things that I've learned in this is, like, hey, every single time someone, like, talks about, like, what it is, it's like I'm re-experiencing. So, like, it's like the PTSD, so it's kind of giving me a lens into it. And so you have to be really, really careful and mindful of, like, how your body is reacting, because, like, technically you're taking yourself back to the place where you were, really, to meet them where they are, you know, if that makes sense.
It takes jumping in the fighting hole with somebody who's got the experience. When you can jump in the fighting hole with that military member or that first responder, that veteran, you are reopening those wounds. And so I tell people a lot of times that work in this business, man, watch your boundaries, okay? You want to help everybody. Some got to learn to help themselves. And I've dealt with a lot of veterans on the outside that just, you know, it goes back to that habit thing. They don't want to do, they want to argue about the VA, or they don't want to quit doing this. They, you know, you got to work with them and meet them halfway. But you can't, I think sometimes, and a problem I had is I took on too much of other people's stuff. And it can be very detrimental. And I experienced that burnout from doing that. And so, you know, I have to keep my boundaries, and I've got to keep my self-care at tip-top shape. Like, that's I know if I have one at work where I'm dealing with somebody, I might go to the gym early. I'm sorry, guys, I'm shutting down, I gotta go. And Darius, you know, he's good about it. He'll see me, hey man, you okay? He'll check in on me, I'll check in on him. So we're constantly doing that with each other, because in this field you're putting a lot of yourself out there. So your self-care routine, you know, mine's get up in the morning, hit the gym. If I don't hit in the morning, I hit in the afternoon. Do some journaling, do some walking. I like to ruck. I love to hunt. I love to shoot my bow. I got into fly fishing with Operation Healing Waters this year, so now I'm a fly fishing fanatic. And a bunch of veterans just get around and talk, and we get to go fishing together. I mean, that's important. Because if you're constantly just putting yourself out there and not taking care of yourself, you really can't help somebody. And so it's self-care. It's probably one of the most important things you can do for yourself, not only for what we do, but just anything across the board. So, yeah.
You know, with all this, I've brought it up a couple times and asked you specifically, you know, what are we looking at numbers-wise in the state? You know, are we better this year? Are we worse off this year? You know, what are we seeing within the Alabama National Guard? What are we doing right? What are we doing wrong? What can leaders do better? What can soldiers do better? What can the state headquarters all the way down do better to?
I'm glad you asked this. I've been excited really to port these numbers. This is not really something that's like official, but again, like as close to the accurate numbers as we know how. Of course, we still have our gray areas and we're trying to be like respectful, you know, like of the people where like this could have been a potential case and we might not have all the insight. But we've basically been tracking these numbers, I think, since 2022, since I got here. And I mean like tracking attempts, ideations, and completed suicides. I am holding really the numbers of 2022 versus 2023. Miss Helena Young, our state BHO, she just emailed me today the numbers for 2024. Everyone has been wondering, hey, is what we're doing working? Is it working? Let me tell you this first. By the number across the board, if you just look at National Guard, I can't really say if we're making a dent in the numbers, right? That's because people are looking at general statistics. However, you know, if you look at Alabama and our numbers and what they have been doing over the last year, they have been decreasing significantly, okay? And I'm just gonna share with you a few things that we found in 2022 and 2023. We basically have the trends of all the data laid out. These are completed suicides, attempts, and ideations. So in 2022, I think we ended the year, with six completed, right? That was a year when we first established that stand down. That's kind of when I think we started getting serious, in air quotes, right? Started getting serious about suicide. We had five back to back, I think within the span of 3 months, right? And so that's the reason why we started doing the stand down in November. That year we had 13 ideations, and I'm not really sure how many attempts we had officially by the paper, right? The following year after that, though, the ideations, they went up, right? Now, most people, they would find that alarming. Well, like, hey, this is a bad thing that's going up. Now, the fact is, we were trying to get people to report, right, when they were feeling, you know? So the higher this number is getting, that's a better thing, which means people are starting to access these resources. They're starting to reach out. The environment is starting to get a little bit more suitable for people to feel like, hey, I can reach out when I do need help. The amount of completed suicides we had officially were two, right? So we went from six to two in the span of a year, okay? Now, this is where things get a little shaky because of the numbers when the fiscal year begins and the official year starts. So we did have two suicides, I think, that sparked up the beginning of this fiscal year officially, right? It was basically at the end of the fiscal year of 23, beginning of the fiscal year of 24, but I think they were in October, right? Now, officially, and our numbers are basically reflecting that we've only had one official suicide for the year of 2024, right? Which means that we've now went from six to two to one, pending, you know, like us having a successful September into early or late October, right? But essentially what we're seeing is there is about to be a full fiscal year, right, where we have not had one completed, right? You know, I don't want to like get ahead of ourselves, but I think that's showing that here in Alabama, I can't speak for the guard as a whole, but like here in Alabama, we're doing something, where we figured out something. I'm not gonna say this is the end of suicide. However, whatever it is that we did for the last two or three years, apparently we need to keep it up.
And our community partners is pushing this Break the Stigma kind of platform. With the introduction of the PACT Act a few years ago, we started getting, you know, most veterans, I think it was like 45% were not enrolled in VA benefits who rated VA. Like people just didn't go. We're starting to see enrollments increase. We're starting to see more people ask for help. Which the VA is like, oh wow, we're having more people come to these our STAR programs, to our vet centers now, and so I think there is an increase. You know, we talked about the ideation increase. That is a positive thing. That means you're, you know, I think I just can't keep but thinking about yesterday because I'm so close to this guy. Had he not called me, you know, that's all I can think because he was in the same platoon that we lost four in. I'm just thinking like, damn, he reached out and called me yesterday in a moment of crisis like that. We got to be doing something right. Something's happening. And you got to remember, these cultural changes take a long period of time. It's not something we can change overnight. You know, if you know the story of John Lister, I mean, we didn't know that washing hands was a real thing in medicine. It took like 12 years for them to go, oh my God, we actually got to wash our hands when we change, you know, cloths or deliver babies. That stops the spread of diseases. It took years for that to change. And so I think it's a cultural thing, and especially with this culture, with the military and first responder community, the way we've been for so long, to try to change that, you know, in one PowerPoint brief, it's not going to happen. It takes a lot of time, and I think it takes a lot of connection and understanding resources and what's out there and what's available, and being involved, being engaged. And I'll speak to this one real quick. Engaged leadership is the number one thing you can do in your unit. Be an engaged leader, be a servant leader, get out there and know your people. That's the first line of defense. Prevention-wise, we can teach resiliency. Prevention-wise, We can do ACE training, prevention wise, we can do all these other things. But at the end of the day, boots on the ground, those NCOs, those young officers, those young commanders, I mean, they've got their thumb on the pulse in the units. So just be mindful when you're. And I think another thing, too, is that we're hitting on big this year is lethal means safety. You've got to have that tough conversation. 85% of the suicides in Alabama in 2022, firearms were the main case. We've got a program right now. We're working with Governor Kay Ivey and the Alabama Challenge, the Governor's Challenge, on a program called Safer Together. And we're working with local gun stores. We are developing a program where a veteran or a military member or a first responder, if they're in transition, having just a time in their life where maybe they don't need to have that firearm next to them, maybe they need to store that firearm for a little while they go seek mental health treatment, they can go take that firearm into an FFL without fear, because it's not a red flag law, it's not a gun grab, this is without fear of losing your Second Amendment right or losing your firearm. It's a voluntary, temporary, confidential program. They can just simply walk into a gun store, drop their weapon off for a certain period of time. There's a 501c called Bearded Warriors that's involved. They have a peer support program, and a peer from Bearded Warriors will reach out to that veteran or that first responder and then help them navigate the system, whatever they might need, whatever risk factor they're dealing with, whether it's relationship, finances, marriage, whatever's contributing to their mental health, they can help out with that. So right now we've got a bill that we're working in the House and the Senate to get passed to protect the FFLs, protect the gun store owners. We hope to be able to release the name publicly here soon of the bill. We're actually going to name the bill after a Marine and a soldier who committed suicide a couple years ago. They're from Alabama. So I'm hoping we can name that bill after those two young men and you know, not forget their you know, the families. And then utilize that as a platform to build more awareness about lethal means and not just firearms. We got to talk about medication too. We know opiates is a big thing, pain pills, all those things. And there's more prescription medication in the homes now today than ever before. I think it was something like 8 billion prescriptions were filled last year in America. I mean, it's just, the stuff's everywhere. So I think it's just building the awareness, building the options, you know, and just keep communicating the same message through and through. Yeah. So,
Jason, Darius, thank you both so much for everything that you're doing for our community. For those of us who are currently serving, for those of us who have exited the military, sometimes after we deal with a lot, it's really easy to just take a step back and be like, hey, that's not really my problem anymore. But each of you have stepped up to the plate.
And again, if you or a loved one are struggling, please reach out, find support, get help, regardless if you're a veteran, currently serving, or even just a friend. We'll be posting links to resources in the episode's description.
Sergeant Hearn, I'm really interested, though. I never got the actual name of that song that touched for Sergeant Ray. What was that?
The song we heard in the episode was Adagio for Strings by Samuel Barber, a 1936 composition. First Sergeant Ray says that he first heard that song in the movie Platoon.
We just want to say a big thank you to everyone who took the time to come talk with us on our podcast, and also to Staff Sergeant Thomas Furlow for doing all of the music for this episode.
And thanks again for listening to AGR, Alabama Guard Radio. You know, as we get more efficient at recording these, we're hoping to get them out faster and faster. That way we can actually be on a recording schedule. But I'm not going to lie, keeping up with these deadlines, well...
You've got to, pardon my phrase, but the pucker factor is quite high.
We'll catch you next time.